Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Page 139. The habit of attention to be cultivated in the infant. The help, then, is not in the will of the child, but in the habit of attention, a habit to be cultivated even in the infant. A baby, notwithstanding his wonderful powers of observation, has no power of attention. In a minute, the coveted plaything drops from listless little fingers, and the wandering glance lights upon some new joy. But even at this stage, the habit of attention may be trained. The discarded plaything is picked up, and with pretty and dumb show, the mother keeps the infant's eyes fixed for fully a couple of minutes. And this is his first lesson in attention. Later, as we have seen, the child is eager to see the handle and handle every object that comes in his way. But watch him at his investigations. He flits from thing to thing with less purpose than a butterfly amongst the flowers, staying at nothing long enough to get the good of it. It is the mother's part to supplement the child's quick observing faculty with a habit of attention. She must see to it that he does not flit from this to that, but looks long enough at one thing to get a real acquaintance with it. Is little Margaret fixing round eyes on the daisy she has plucked? In a second, the daisy will be thrown away, and a pebble or a buttercup will charm the little maid. But the mother seizes the happy moment. She makes Margaret see the daisy is a bright yellow eye with white eyelashes round it, that all the day long it lies there in the grass and looks up at the great sun, never blinking as Margaret would do, but keeping its eye wide open. And that is why it is called a daisy, day's eye, because its eye is always looking at the sun, which makes the day. And what does Margaret think it does at night, when there is no sun? It does what little boys and girls do. It just shuts up its eyes with its white lashes tipped with pink and goes to sleep till the sun comes again to the morning. By the time the daisy has become interesting to Margaret, she looks at it with big eyes after her mother has finished speaking, and then, very likely, cuddles it up into her breast or gives it a soft little kiss. Thus, the mother will contrive ways to invest every object in the child's world with interest and delight. Attention to things, words, a weariness. But the tug of war begins with the lessons of the schoolroom. Even the child who has gained the habit of attention to things finds words a weariness. This is a turning point in a child's life and the moment for the mother's tact and vigilance. In the first place, never let the child dawdle over copy book or sum, sit dreaming with his book before him. When a child grows stupid over a lesson, it is time to put it away. Let him do another lesson as unlike the last as possible, and then go back with freshened wits to this unfinished task. If mother or governess have been unwary enough to let the child moon over a lesson, she must just exert her wits to pull him through. The lesson must be done, of course, but must be made bright and pleasant to the child. Lessons attractive. The teacher should have some knowledge of the principles of education, should know what subjects are best fitted for the child considering his age, and how to make these subjects attractive, should know, too, how to vary the lessons, so that each power of the child's mind should rest after effort, and some other power be called into play. She should know how to incite the child to effort through his desire of approbation, of excelling, of advancing, his desire of knowledge, his love of his parents, his sense of duty, in such a way that no one set the motive to be called unduly into play to the injury of the child's character. But the danger she must be especially alive to is the substitution of any other natural desire for that of knowledge, which is equally natural, and it's adequate for all the purpose of education.